uploaded, so excuse me. And apparently I'm talking into a mic that isn't on. Okay, I was apologising for... I hadn't uploaded all of the images. I put it onto a web slideshow so that it could be more easily recorded and streamed. So my name's Tom Hall. I'm That Tommy Hall on various internets. You might know me as That Tarsier Guy. I give this talk a rather awkward title, so thanks for coming. It's probably the abstract more than the title that interested you, if that's the case. I think this talk should have been called something like On Being a Scribe in Ancient Egypt, or A Big List of Things Tom Likes, or Things Tom Rants About in the Pub with Beer. So I want to talk about sort of how, as a culture, we handle big ideas. So at some point, the big idea was agriculture, so growing stuff was like the big idea, sort of 15,000 years ago or whatever. And what happens is it becomes a way of increasing population densities. Actually, health goes down when we start to grow things, but I think life is somehow less precarious because you can have food shortages and stuff, although people are less healthy and they don't live as long, which is kind of reaching forward to our modern day where we live in a world of abundance and we destroy ourselves with awful food that we create for ourselves. But also it allows concentration of power that's not previously possible. So I want to just talk about a few creations, discoveries, and then how they're used and how that might be relevant to software development or programming or computation. So if you'll bear with me. At one point, again, writing was the great idea. This comes not long after the agricultural revolution, from what we can tell. So writing becomes the big thing. Or not the big thing in the sense of everybody doing it, but the big thing in the sense of it's very important. So the scribes, or I don't know if they would be called scribes in Mesopotamia, actually, but this is cuneiform, so what's considered to be the first script. It was used using wedge-shaped markers into clay tablets, which were then baked. So it may just be that they were the most durable form, so we have to be a bit wary of thinking people were obsessed with burying people and obsessed with stones when they may actually have had quite a rich material culture that just doesn't survive. So as always with archaeology, you have to be wary of like the survival bias of the sort of durable objects. So yeah, writing was a big idea. In the Mayan civilization, it was actually knots. So they would tie knots and send people running through the hills between the towns to try and send messages and stuff. But again, not everybody was doing this, just the rulers are using it. But, and I think relevant to lots of us, the people who were in that position, who had the special skills, firstly, it's quite often people who are already rich, who can afford to train their children in the thing that is important to Pharaoh or whatever. And as I say, it becomes an instrument of power. It's how Pharaoh measures his taxes. It's how he decides. It's how he declares war in large part. It's how he celebrates his victories. Or if you study ancient Egypt, they always celebrate their victories. And you have to. You can detect their defeats by the victories become closer to home again as they get sort of chased out of other areas, which is quite nice. Sorry, I don't know why I remembered that. That's not relevant to my argument. So, writing was the great idea. At first, it was an elite few that did it. They were special and they were treated, and it was an instrument of power. This is a Lindisfarne gospel. You can see them in Lindisfarne, or the British Library have a few good examples. So these are sort of many, many man hours per page, and it was man hours then. I'm not being sexist. They were. So many, many man hours into them. Again, rich people can afford them. A special priestly class deals with the creation of these artifacts. And again, I don't want to say instruments of power because I might upset the religious among you. I would say access to them was limited. Not necessarily the case with some of these. Some of these would have been devotional objects shared in churches and stuff. But certainly the spare capacity to afford their creation was only for the wealthy. I put a note to myself because I can't necessarily guarantee that the pictures will trigger everything. So I found out quite recently, in terms of we talk about privilege and stuff like that. At one point, if you could recite Psalm 51 in Latin, you were tried by an ecclesiastical court, not a civil court, and they were much more lenient. So when you look now at like the differences of, you know, crack cocaine sentencing versus powdered cocaine sentencing and the societal connotations there and the color of your skin correlating with how severe your sentences are, how likely you are to be stopped and searched, etc. Actually being able to, well, they said read, but really if you were smart enough to remember the sounds, you could do it. And I always read a chap called Gordon Child on this stuff, so sort of early civilization, from a sort of moderately left-wing perspective. He's been called a Marxist archaeologist, but I don't think that's the case. But I discovered during the more recent last few days' worth of research a chap called Harvey J. Graff. Now, that's just more a note to me and to yourselves that it might be worth taking a peek at him, more contemporary historian of sort of, I guess cultural historian. Sorry. I am not a religious scholar. Oh, by the way, sorry, I had a disclaimer that I nearly added. I think to sort of paraphrase Brendan Eich on JavaScript, anything that's good in this talk is probably not original, and anything that's original is probably not good. So full disclaimer, yeah. And also, yeah, I'm not a religious studies expert. And then the printing press came along, democratized things, but as you probably know, there was a battle around that as well. Who gets to control them? Is it illegal? Who gets? And they're also large, expensive devices, so then it's very likely that you are a wealthy to-do person before you can get one. So people club together, they start using them, then they're made illegal, etc. So again, there's always battles around technology. There's people here who I think can talk better about that. Coincidentally, while I was preparing this talk, I started reading a book called The Intellectuals and the Masses. So this is a chap called John Carey, who was invited to give a very prestigious lecture series on, or I think a single lecture on modernism, and basically slaughtered the whole endeavor. I'm not saying I agree entirely with his premise, which seems to be that as mass literature arrives, so from say 1850 to 1900, you start to get mass literature. By 1920, most people in Western Europe can read. And the intellectuals say, well, what makes us special now? Why, if everybody can do this, we can't allude to books we've read, and we can't be the ones that have the secret knowledge. So his argument is that essentially literary modernism, this sort of what seems to me impenetrable work, which I mean I'm conflicted because I have good friends that are really, really into it and really value it, and so I don't want to say I'm sort of all in with Carey here, but I think the book does paint the actual, and I know it's a bit ad hominem, but the actual characters doing this work are pro-fascist, pro-euthanasia, like what's worse than euthanasia, my mind's gone a blank, the one where you just want to kill lots of people, not necessarily people that want it. I'm thinking eugenics, they call it, didn't they? Good genics, yeah, sorry. Excuse me, my memory's a little off. I'm a little bit unwell. So yeah, his argument is that that is the point of it. The point of it is to exclude people. So there's another book by a chap called Hoggart called... shouldn't try and do things off the cuff. Uses of Literacy it is, and he kind of takes a different view to this, where he thinks that the masses are kind of being dumbed down, whereas this is an opposing or opposite view, that the intellectuals are sort of retreating somewhere else, which I thought was quite interesting. So, and yeah, and it was actually D.H. Lawrence actually explicitly says that they're trying to create a body of esoteric doctrine defended from the herd. So if the point of it is almost to exclude people. And I worry when I look at the discourse in communities I'm part of, and let's say someone discovers Haskell, they're really, really happy that, you know, they found this new purely functional thing. And then you talk to them about, you know, somebody who does PHP or whatever, and they're like, oh no, that's, you know, that's disgusting. And I don't know if it's, are we trying to bring everyone along to the nice place we are, where we are? Are we trying to say, I found something great, guys, come on, pile in, let's all go and have a look at this? Or are we saying, I kind of like that, I know what a homo, you know, homomorphism is, and are we saying that, you know, oh, I like the reserved words, and I'm not arguing that people are, well, I'm not arguing that all people are necessarily, but I think there's a danger of it. There's a danger of finding something new and sneering at the masses that are left over. Oh, still doing Java. Oh, ooh, etc. So, just wanted us to be aware of that. One thing. Sorry, this is a bit rambly. So excuse me. I'm not going to change it. I'm just going to apologize in the middle. What do you say? Hat. Was that? Oh, sorry. I thought someone said. Excuse me. I thought someone said hat. And I was trying to figure out why that looked like a hat. So mathematics is another area of interest of mine. My degree was in mathematics. So this is a Babylonian clay tablet again. Again, using the same wedge-shaped things to make the indentations. It was much easier to be a polymath back then. So the people that were the writers were also the mathematicians, were also in large part the philosophers. That becomes less true over time as we kind of branch out and find our little niche in order to take knowledge forward and get our PhDs, etc. So this is actually, I think I stole it from Wikipedia, and it's somehow depicting the square root of 2, which they did know about, which is quite interesting. So now I'm going to talk briefly about mathematics. Mathematics has a similar kind of path where it starts off as a thing just for the elite, then it's an instrument of power again, like how much taxes do you go, how much interest do I apply to that loan, you know, the wongas of the sort of Bronze Age or whatever. And then now everybody sort of kind of does it. Now this isn't as true as literacy that everybody really does mathematics with the fluency with which they do read and write. Now I was a maths teacher for a while, and so I can when I say this that it's the fault of education, I mean it's my fault as well. But some things are, so sometimes things enter into the vernacular and you don't really know they have. So when I was a kid, I used to play top trumps, and one of the numbers that you could, everyone knows how top trumps work, right? You choose a category or a trait or something and you compete on the numbers high and low, etc. One of the top trump stats was 0 to 60 and how many seconds it took. Now, that idea is a compound rate of change, isn't it? It's a second order differential. Like, that is actually unthinkable, sort of pre-calculus. I think acceleration is actually in itself quite a complicated topic. But people now that drive cars do understand it. So there's the even though they don't think they're doing mathematics, there is a conversational fluency with what is quite a complicated idea, like a second order differential. People thought for a long time that heavier things fell faster and things like this, and gravitation kind of took a while to arrive. Actually, I noticed when I searched for this image, and I don't know if this is the dumbing down of education, but that is no longer on the no longer on the car, the only car image I could find. So as I was preparing this talk, I think I've got via osmosis something from this chap at IBM Watson, the research lab, I think outside New York. And the article, it's more of a book, in fact, is about notation as a tool of thought. So I've long, when I first studied calculus, I thought that there was certain things are easy because of the way the notation's chosen. So apologies for the iffy image. You know, if you say dy by dx, that's the rate of change in y with respect to x. If you actually have it in terms of another variable, this equation is true. And people think it's obvious because the dt's just cancel like a fraction. Actually, you might know Newton and Leibniz kind of not co-discovered, as in working together, because I think Newton was a bit of he wasn't a very nice person from what I can tell. It looks obvious that dt's cancel like you would a fraction. In reality, Leibniz, absolute genius, chose this notation because these rules work. 1 over dy by dx is dx over dy, if you remember fractions. It's exactly the same thing. Dy by, this is the right way around off the cuff, dy by dt divided by dx by dt would be dy by dx. So again, you divide by flipping and then multiplying. So the vision to see that this thing had the same properties that people already know from fraction, and choosing a good notation and letting the notation do some of the work, I think a stunning bit of insight by Leibniz. More recently, I've been studying quantum mechanics, so I never actually did it at university. And I thought another similar, very nice example was, we've long had this notation on the left for an inner product. So A and B are vectors, the inner product. You might see sometimes we write A dot B, and that's basically a scalar quantity related to the two vectors. Dirac had an insight with this operator of separating it out into a bra and a ket, and using the properties of those two operators, like how they distribute, etc., chose a great notation. So the notation actually helps. There may be better quantum physicists than I in the audience that perhaps want to grab people at the end and go through exactly why that's awesome. So there I kind of liked it. Again, chosen a notation. You put those two things next to each other. You apply that operator on the left to the operator on the right. You get the inner product, which is just a scalar. But then you have also, like, as I say, sort of distributive laws and things like that within them. So if you have, like, a bunch of these things, you can group them together. And because they're rather associative, you can actually take them in pairs and sort of cancel them all down. And again, so the notation's kind of working for you. The quote I wanted, and I saw it in SICP, so the Jerry Sussman, I think it might be a Dijkstra quote, where he says, we're so early in the age of computer science that we confuse the tool with the topic. So we think it's about computers, and it's like calling biology microscope science. So there's a microscope scientist doing some work for animal health welfare charity. This idea that we've confused the tool with the topic. So how did the topic come around? So at the turn of the last century, so like 1900 or so, there was a program to formalize all of mathematics. Now, there's very good reasons why we should be happy that people didn't succeed. Because without Gödel's theorem, mathematics would by now have been very boring. So nobody was thinking about computers as we have them. They were just thinking about ways of guaranteeing things were true by starting with axioms and then using only symbol manipulation, using only explicit rules that are also, I was going to say, machine checkable. That isn't quite what they said. That were checkable by some procedure. So this is from a textbook I used. And the idea is your rules you're using are on the right, and then you're in the world of only manipulating symbols. Now, the point of these formal systems is anything you show in the formal system, anything you derive, is actually true in the real world. So a proof, which is just something you find in the formal system, corresponds to a truth. So the hope was that we could get to all mathematical truths by choosing enough assumptions and the correct set of rules. Now, no set of rules is adequate, which is great, because it means mathematicians will be in a job for a long time. But the problem was, is they're talking about, so this is, at every step here, you've got multiple choices, there's loads of different rules you might use, and you have some goal, it's directed by a human at this point. So at this point, you make assumptions, but you've got a goal in mind, you use the rules, but you've still got an end in mind, and at some point you say, well, I'm done now, and then the property of the formal system is every line of this proof can be checked by, you know, a dumb procedure, but this is still sort of requiring insight. So the next step is trying to express procedures unambiguously. So the two most common ones are the Turing machine and the Lambda calculus. Hopefully if this refreshes, I had some trouble uploading my, I've spoiled the joke now. And I've lost my picture of the Lambda calculus. So the Lambda calculus, from an initial starting point, it evolves deterministically. At every stage, there's only one thing you can do. And then it ends. So it's much more like a computer program. So we go from, I'm going to be very hand-wavy on the Lambda calculus bit, I'm afraid. So here we say, human sets up some assumptions. Human uses the rules he knows about to get the result he wants and then says, I'm done. The Lambda calculus is, here is some expression that satisfies the rules. Every step, we say, apply the rule. I can't do anything anymore. That is now terminated. We're now done with that. We have the result of doing that computation. Turing machine is very, very similar. Move up and down the tape, got some rules, read and write from the cells, move up and down. And at some point, you know that you're done. So, what time are we on? Sorry, I can't see a clock. 24, okay. I was going to say, we've got more computing power in our pockets than anybody realized. And I think everybody thinks, yeah, my iPhone's really powerful. But in reality, almost anything would be more powerful than they realized. Doing these things by hand is almost impossible. So, I wanted to talk now, so that's kind of how computers arose. They arose out of mathematical logic. Then suddenly we put them in a dumb device that does loads of things really quickly, and then suddenly we arrive at like the computer revolution, if it can be called that. But now we can use them to do other stuff. So given that they exist, and again, I meant to say before, we always talk about programming languages and stuff. So we always say we have like, you know, the Haskell meetup or the whatever language you like meetup. But then I don't know if in ancient Egypt they had like the particular pen meetup, the kind of papyrus meetup, or whether they were so invested, like who has the best papyrus? Oh, you use the slightly yellow one. I use the more browny red one, you know. So I don't know whether that's the case. But given that these things exist, how can we use them? And is it dumb to use them or is it smart? So I was always with older mathematics teachers, or that's less common, in fact, being unfair to them, with older people who've studied mathematics in the past and who are arithmetically much more efficient than I am. I think using a tool to sort of save you the effort is really good, and certain other things become possible that weren't previously. So we can say to a kid now, for instance, what happens if you take a number and keep taking the square root? Where does it go? So you might say they choose 9, keep pressing the square root, where does it go? And the answer is, and this calculator does behave like the ones I had. You basically overflow and you can't tell the difference anymore, and at some point it's just one. So there's some accuracy that it doesn't display, and at some point the calculator declares bankruptcy and just says it's one. That's a really interesting discussion. So what if you say to the kids, you start with a really big number and you keep pressing the square root, what happens? And it's actually it's good for your intuition, this. I'm not doing any calculation, but I've got a great intuition that, for one thing, taking the square root makes a number small really quickly. For another thing, that this iterative process, after however many iterations, converges on one really quickly. That's an insight that like a 50 pence calculator can give me that would have been very hard for somebody before it to really get. And there's a great question now. I've just gone through, obviously not exhaustively, because the real numbers, there's quite a lot of them, but I've gone through like quite a few examples now, and I'm developing an intuition. So a good question might be, well, what would be a good number to try? You know, a kid's got some good intuition, maybe. We'll say, well, what about a number less than one? What happens there? So, is clear a button? Yeah, cool. So what about a number less than one? So 0.002, say. And does this have the same behavior? So what does it mean? It's getting bigger. And then again, it converges on one from below. So you've got basically a dynamic system that you start up here, it heads towards one. You start down there, it heads towards one. A great next question, or maybe they said, you know, what happens with one? And he's like, great. Oh, so there you've got your fixed point anyway. And then if a kid's very smart, they might say, well, what about minus numbers? And then you're straight away into a very interesting discussion, aren't you? So you're straight away into a very interesting discussion, but you're not doing any calculation because the dumb machine's done it for you really quickly. So that's kind of what I really enjoyed about the fact that you can use computers not talk about computers. I'm not talking about the JavaScript that implements this. This is just a machine that I'm using to illustrate some other points. So I thought that was rather nice. Yeah, so let me do that for you. All of A-level mathematics, certainly, and a good slice of degree-level mathematics, in fact, can be solved by Mathematica now. So if you really do want to solve problems, use the tool, get those dumb machine churning really fast to do it for you. Sorry, I've gone off full screen. So leverage them wherever you can, leave the insight that's necessary for you. So one sort of final demo was, again, developing an intuition in a way that is completely impossible before computers. So if you ever did any pencil and compass constructions, they're actually really hard, and especially if you're dyspraxic or whatever, or you have like attention problems, because it's actually takes ages. It's actually fairly boring, the process. The revelation at the end isn't actually that good, and you basically take, I don't know if you've done it, if you might remember, you take a shape, a 2D shape, and you can enlarge it, transform it, rotate it, etc. So one thing I absolutely adored was some software called Geo. Well, I had a non-free version. There's a free version called GeoGebra, which is great, which lets you set up. Can you see the origin here, the little green dot? And then the F is the thing I'm going to rotate. So if I fix the origin there and then rotate through some angle, what does it look like? So here I've got a sort of dynamic view of what it's like. So at zero, if I rotate none and then I start going through it, that the extra intuition you get from knowing, well, roughly where's it going to be, etc., you can't really get with a compass construction or a ruler construction, because it just takes ages. Similar for reflections. Actually getting a feel for what reflection is as an operation is actually quite hard, and you can kind of mechanically follow the steps, you know, go to the mirror, go out the same angle, etc., but to get an idea intuitively of what it means, what happens if the mirror becomes very close to the object, or I think I can move the object as well. Oh no, I can't in this one. Or the object becomes very close to the mirror, what happens there, and does that really make sense? And like, they can do things that perhaps you wouldn't do otherwise. Two more of these, because I like them. Oh no, that one's not working. Oh yeah, cool. So this one is brilliant. So enlargement via a scale factor. You might remember in the bottom left corner is the sort of center of enlargement. Here's my shape. So if I change the shape, the enlarged shape changes. That's really good. This would be a ruler line in the normal case, or the pre-computer case. But here I'm just moving it around to sort of build up my intuition. So if I change that one changes. If I change this one, obviously this one changes. And that's really good for developing an intuition for what actually enlargement does. And what does the scale factor do? So you're always, if I was to construct this with a ruler, I would basically take that point, draw lines through the points I'm interested in, and I would measure the distance to the first one, and I would say, oh, well, if I want a scale factor 3, I'll go 3 times as far, and then the image that's drawn is 3 times as big. So sorry if you perhaps don't remember the school mathematics, but now what if we change the enlargement factor? So really, really nice is, scale factor 2, it's twice as big. Scale factor 3, it's three times as big. But further away, you see how we're going along those rays. And really nice is, well, you can ask kids, well, what do you think scale factor 1 will be? And it's actually a really easy question asked like this. You say, well, what's scale factor 1 going to be? And they go, well, it'll just be the same. That's a really hard insight to arrive at, actually. And you go, well, what about a fractional one? And it's an almost impossible question until you've seen this. But if I say now, What's one going to be? What's fractional going to be? Actually, it's much easier to get, you know, a fraction of a half, it being closer to the center of enlargement and half the size. Actually, really good intuition. And one more, which is the most difficult one, is bisecting a line. So this was known by Euclid. But you've got two points here, A, B. I've drawn a circle more than half of the distance between them, the same size from each. Where those circles intersect, I've drawn another line. That line is a perpendicular bisector of the line AB. So I'm sorry if you can't see that very well. But the great thing, again, for developing that intuition is, well, what if A and B were further apart? Oh, well, it still works, doesn't it? What if C was shorter, so my circumference of the circles was shorter? And again, straight away, you visualize the condition of, oh, it only works if I go at least half of the distance. But as long as I go the same distance on each side, the bisector works. So that's really nice. You rather than say to the kids, you've got a rule, you have to go at least halfway, you draw them and then it bisects the line. They can see why then. They know if it doesn't reach quite halfway that the circles don't intersect at all. And then you can, I think that's, obviously move the circle in, make the line shorter. I think that's really nice. So, that's basically using the output of programming or coding or whatever to get insights into something else. One other thing I've been interested in recently is using the actual method itself. So using programming, using the fact that we can unambiguously express procedural knowledge to learn other things. So Jerry Sussman and Jack Wisdom have got a whole introduction to classical mechanics using the programming language scheme rather than normal mathematics, which I thought was an interesting idea. There's introductions to Bayesian statistics and statistics using Python, which I kind of liked. It's like, given that you know Python, let's learn statistics rather than perhaps the other way around. So I thought, again, that was interesting. It's like, using the fact that you know programming to learn something else. So that was a little bit meandering, so thank you for your indulgence. So my only conclusion is, I guess, are we being esoteric, or are we inviting people to these things that we've decided objectively as beings of pure rationality that are better than the other things? Are we inviting people in, or are we kind of glad that we're in an elite group of people that know the secrets? What happens when everybody does it? I think it's an interesting problem. Ooh. I think it's an interesting idea, an interesting premise. And if it gets to the point where it's like writing, where everybody just does it as a matter of course, oh yeah, just program the car to do whatever, I think that'd be awesome. And the idea we can use the output of this great idea, this computation, to support other stuff, but we can also directly use the idea. So given that people already know computation, given that people already know a programming language, can we use it as a medium of explaining it the same way I would use the fact I can read to learn about churches in Gothic France or something? So, thanks very much.